Yeah, so we're on the other side of the Appalachians than J.D. Vance. He well, sort of. I think his book was kind of set in Eastern Kentucky, and then they moved to Ohio. And that part of Ohio is definitely sort of still kind of Western Kentucky. Like it's a very interesting
culturally
geographic area.
I could imagine that mountains, because they're relatively impassable, would tend to give you different cultures of people, maybe different species or whatever, because, you know, why bother migrating across a mountain if you can just, you know, make a satisfactory life, you know, on one side.
Yeah, and that's the thing. So a lot of people who sort of are from that area even have different dialects based on which they call them hollers or hollows, which, you know, little valley they're in. So, you know, people, there are, you know, stories of people living in the same holler their entire life and then going out to the big city and just being, you know, shocked. And still today, there's you know, some fascinating subcultures and areas around there. So I'm sort of like, who was it? I think Mayor Pete Buttigieg, or now Secretary Buttigieg. The other day, I was watching one of the political shows, and he was on, and they asked if he had read Hillbilly Elegy, and he said, "It's one of those books that I own that I haven't read."
Same with that me. Is a hell of a diss. That's a very that's like a damning with faint praise kind of a.
Yeah, it's like I paid the money, but I'm not going to take the ride. So
right.
Yeah, my wife has read it, and I remember she read it when it came out, and she was a big fan. She said, "You know, you should read this. You would like it," because I love this sorts of anthropological, you know, studies of unique cultures and food ways and all that kind of stuff. And we have a lot of that here in the American South. But yeah, we're on the other side of the mountains, basically. But we're sort of in the Piedmont now, so
right.
It's nice. I love it.
Huh. So would that be then your hollows? Would they be like how like different parts of England have different accents, dialects, whatever? I only know a few of them, but I understand there's like a gazillion of them based on, you know, which pocket of England versus Scotland versus Wales, which is like so different.
Yeah, and even within England, you know, you have Cockney, which I think was like the Mary Poppins type language, and then you have, you know, the London stuff, and then you have Sussex, and then you have York and Yorkshire and all those areas. So, yeah, we definitely have that. So here in South Carolina, we've talked about this before, but you've got three different types of barbecue sauce and really? Three different parts. Yeah, so people down in the coastal plain, sort of Charleston and where I grew up down in the what's called the PD region down near the coast, we're all vinegar-based. And you go into a you know, dive bar or some little local restaurant, you say, "I want a barbecue sandwich," and you're going to get pulled pork and vinegar sauce. But if you go to the Midlands, which is like Columbia, kind of in the middle of the state, you're going to get mustard-based sauce, yellow. And then you come up here, and it's sort of like this Texas tomato-based barbecue sauce, like what, you know, what you think of when you go to the grocery store and pick up, a barbecue sauce, right. Which I think is gross. But yeah, I grew up with vinegar sauce, but our dialects are also very different. So you can tell someone who's from Greenville compared to someone who's from Charleston, and Charleston has its very, very own distinct, dialect and pronunciation. And even, you know, there's a lot of pastels and pinks and blues and your seersucker stuff in Charleston. Whereas up here in Greenville, there's a, you know, much more of a mismatch of dialects and accents because it's more metropolitan. But yeah, so even here in this, you know, state that's growing rapidly but still tiny, there's all sorts of dialects.
That reminds me how there's like two major types of soy sauce in Japan. There's like the Tokyo-centered one, like the dominant one, and then the Southern Island has its own, you know, particular variety or whatever. I'm sure that there will be, you know, transitional prefectures, whatever, where you have a blend of both. But yeah, interesting.
What's the Southern Island?
Yeah, the Southern Island is called Kyushu, like the southernmost one. The main one is called Honshu. That's like the big boomerang-shaped one. But it never occurred to me that there was more than one type of, of barbecue sauce. I just see Kraft or, you know, whatever, generic store brand.
Yeah, no, that's, I've got to send you a bottle. Yeah, there's some really great stuff that's, we call it vinegar-based, and it's clear and it's very spicy. People from Texas come here and they have you know, East Carolina barbecue, and they're like, what is this? Because it tastes like vinegar on pulled pork. But yeah. But yeah, it's good. Now, have you ever heard of Buc-ee's, the big gas station?
I have, yes.
Okay, yeah, so we just had a Buc-ee's move in into the lower state near where we used to live. And people there are blown away because they have brisket, which we don't do in South Carolina. So and you can make
kind of a type of a thing, or
yeah, it's a type of barbecue that's yeah. Like a whole chunk of barbecue rather than kind of like pulled pork barbecue, and people love it evidently. I tried one with my golf team last spring, and I liked it, but it's fascinating to see something like Buc-ee's move in here because it's sort of like a Tim Hortons, I guess, in Canada, where you know, the type of coffee you get from there is going to be a little different than what you might get in Vancouver. And just the food and everything is a little different because it's so Texas based. So even then, you know, even though Texas is in the South and we're in the South and Florida's in the South, we sort of all have our own little variations, much like ancient Judea, you know, where you've got the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, you know, that kind of stuff.
So I was actually about to make a comment that like vinegar, I think, is the base from which you get ketchup, mustard, relish, mayonnaise. And so I was actually going to make a thought that you have Judaism, which is kind of at the heart, or you know, which Christianity winds up springing out of, you know, a variety or a variation without dietary restrictions, and Islam somewhat later, a variation with dietary restrictions. And I'm not sure if Mormonism is big enough now, but then that's a further offshoot. But yeah, I guess it might be interpreted poorly to say that Judaism is like the vinegar of monotheistic religions. But anyway, just an interesting, interesting thing that it's sort of formative to these others.
Yeah, and then you have Akhenaten, you know, over in Egypt doing his thing with to convert everyone over to the study or to the worship of Aten, and that didn't go so well. But yeah, I think that whole concept of the origins of monotheism is such a fun area for people to hop into because it's murky. You know, we've lost a lot of that to the sands of time. And you know, I've read some great articles lately on, you know, Adonai being some sort of a deity that was found in, you know, sort of the very south of Israel, now sort of near what's now Beersheba, way down towards the Red Sea, and sort of this almost Vulcan type god. He was a god of metallurgy or something like that. You know, who knows? But yeah, just that concept that we get. But then again, even in the Hebrew Bible, the concept of monotheism is, I mean, this is personal opinion based on my own studies, this is a much later concept than Genesis 1,
right,
which itself is pretty late, you know. Right. But even in Genesis 1, we get, you know, sort of the hosts of the Almighty, or the host of God, or you know, this sort of crowd that's around. And Jonah and going all the way to Job, you know, we get these stories, but they're not monotheistic stories. And this concept of what we call monotheism, I would say, is read much more into the stories than we give it credit for. So even then, I don't think if you were to, you know, travel back in time in some sort of a biblical time machine, you would meet people living in the area that we call Israel now who would understand that concept that they're just being one God.
Right.
The Ten Commandments don't really make sense if that's the case. But
right. Yeah. Well, exactly. Like, if there were no other gods, then there's no concern about having some other god take a pole position, as it were, in terms of a worship ceremony.
Yeah, we try to explain that away by saying, you know, we make, you know, college football our god, or we make, you know, Manchester United our god, but you know, you have to put Almighty on high. And I'm like, I don't think God was really concerned about, you know, Liverpool or Man U. I think, you know, there's a lot more going on there. So, yeah, for those sermons preached.
Is that henotheism? It's like your local representative, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of a henotheistic idea, and that's something in my own studies I've pushed more and more into panentheism, where it's sort of like the divine is kind of like the force in Star Wars, where it's a, you know, it's a part of everything. It's, you know, Gospel of Thomas, split a piece of wood and I am there, lift a stone and I am there. And for me personally, in my own theology, that's much closer to, you know, the deity in the sky who sort of is above and outside of nature, or I hate the word nature, above and, and outside of the ecology of the universe.
That sounds like almost like, is it Platonistic? Like this idea that there's a perfection thing of which the current world is like an imperfect mirror. There is some perfect triangle with a capital T out there, of which earthly representations are, you know, by limits, can never, you know, are aspects of, but not quite the real thing.
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking at a couple of books here myself with Plutarch and some of those folks who were Neoplatonists and who sort of really developed that idea. I think Plato had his idea of Platonic shapes and some of those concepts that would later flesh out into that sort of, you know, Platonic ideal that we say today. But I don't think Plato, the person himself, would really go along with all of that. But definitely that's what Platonism becomes, especially in the early Christian period, when I think early followers of what is becoming Christianity in the third centuries are really adopting these Platonist ideals. And that really does meld in well with what becomes Orthodox Christianity, not in the current religion, but just Orthodox in terms of what develops. Yeah. Exactly. There's this perfect table in the sky, and that's what, you know, every table on earth is modeled after. But these tables are all corrupt, and they degrade and break over time.
Right. I'm just going back to the sort of reading back into history monotheism when it might not have originally been there. I know your guys' Supreme Court has these originalist guys or something, and my understanding is that is a departure from, I don't know, whatever the previous, you know, let's adjust for the times, for, you know, what would have been considered. And I would be idly curious, but a little scared to time jump, say 200 or 300 years, to see if what you guys had a ruling or something that the president, as long as they're doing something in an official order, isn't illegal. You know, there's some very peculiar to an outsider apparent ruling, and it would sound like that's a case of someone saying, well, we may not have had this tradition until 2024, but we are now saying that, you know, the original intent was it was supposed to be a certain way. It just seems like a bit of a parallel about how, I don't know, maybe what it was, the priestly author maybe retrojected some of their contemporary ideas and tried to layer it into older traditions, which might not have otherwise been as convenient.
Yeah, and that's and for folks who are listening, Matthew is from British Columbia, so we have these great conversations about Canadian politics, and I'm always asking about Pierre Trudeau and are the rumors true? We hear such terrible things here in the United States. No, so we, you know, it's fun to have these cross border conversations. What I think of, and you said that well with the priestly tradition, I always think of Josiah, you know, and to me Josiah is sort of the buildup of the entire Hebrew Bible. So, and this is going to be tricky for people who aren't into First and Second Kings like I am, but when you get the Deuteronomistic history, as we call it, which is a colonialist term, I kind of, but when you get that set of texts that is really informed by what we call Deuteronomy, and then Hilkiah and the priest find supposedly this text of Deuteronomy in the temple that they're remodeling for Josiah, they bring it to him and Hezekiah, and they say, hey, you know, we found these texts. And the king is very upset and tears his clothes and puts on sackcloth and reads this and says, this is what we're supposed to be doing all along. So we're going to go cut down all the high places. We're going to destroy the Asherah, the tall poles. We're going to take down the Nehushtan, which is the stick with the bronze serpent. Mm-hmm. So that sort of period of religious reform is inspired by this finding of, and I did that in air quotes, this finding of what we call Deuteronomy, which is a very heavy, I think, later priestly text that explains the cultic life of what would become Judaism. And there are similarities to sort of what we have now. And there's always been this back and forth in the United States. And for my friends who were very into government, I'm going to butcher this and I apologize, but from a layperson's point of view, who loves watching politics, this is my interpretation. We've always had this tension between what we call construct or what was it, sort of the literalist sort of the Constitution is a foundational document that should not be altered or destroyed, you know, sort of like the Bible, right? Take no word out of this or you will suffer, like in Revelation. So we have these strict constructionalists who say, you know, this is how the founding fathers wanted this. And they were very intent, and this is what, you know, word for word, this is how we should read it and interpret it. And then you've always had sort of the more liberal, and I use that word not in a political sense, but liberal as in, you know, read it and interpret and use your best judgment to make a judgment. And that has over time, over the definitely the last 40 or 50 years, since things like Brown versus Board of Education, which ended segregation in the US South, Plessy versus Ferguson, even Roe v. Wade, these decisions that were made using more of a you know liberal mindset of being able to read into the text of the Constitution and say, well, it doesn't say this in the text, but obviously this is what the founders were trying to imply. Those major readings that led to things like the Civil Rights Act and led to even things like the EPA being founded under Nixon, of all people, those readings, Roe v. Wade, were inspired by that more liberal side. But now we've got this huge shift back, but it's not sort of your 1980s President Reagan sort of there was a guy named Bork, I think Richard Bork,
I remember
who
his name became like a verb or something for like being rejected.
and people still use it today, you know, you got Borked. Evidently he rented some naughty VHS tapes at his local VHS tape place
Oh.
and that got out. So poor guy, it was before the internet was full of that sort type of information, I
Right.
guess, or material. Anyway, so he was a very conservative, strict, you know, foundationalist construction type guy. But the conservative judges that are on the court now really had a big changeover after people like Justice Scalia passed away, or I'm trying to think of the other major player, Rehnquist was
Ruth
it.
Bader Ginsburg or
Ruth
something,
Bader
right?
Ginsburg was, yeah, she was very progressive on the other side, very liberal. And she was kind of a check, and that's always been kind of the case. There's always been a 5-4 split, nine justices. We don't know why. We just agreed on nine. There could be more, and that's what a lot of sort of politically progressive people are pushing for to kind of offset what we've seen. Because under Donald Trump, there were a number of judges that were passed through that were very conservative, but not conservative in the sense of 1980s, 90s
Right.
conservative. Yeah, so it's been a
Would they,
lot.
if we go back to the word radical, I think radical means like to go back to the root of. If they're saying that they want to go to an originalist kind of thing, does that definitionally, but not in the political overtone sense, would that be a radical, like going to the what they think the root is kind of a view?
Yeah, and we use the term radical right and radical left all the
Right.
time. So someone is you know way over on the right and they want to do away with Roe v. Wade, they want to do away with Voting Rights Act and Title IX and sort of these social policies, do away with the Department of Education, always a big talking point. They're part of the radical right. But if someone wants to do away with funding the police departments or they want to you know really focus on more social side of things, that's radical left. So yeah, we use those terms a whole lot, just in common parlance.
Now, just riffing back on Josiah discovering the original scrolls, I had a moment of that sort when we were we moved into a new place a few years ago, and we took out the old like sinks and stuff in the bathroom, and I guess you can't hear it on audio, but there was this little toothbrush holder with a little sheet of paper in it, which someone had hidden behind the little lip of the underboard of the sink. And so where was it from here? I won't read the whole thing, but basically this was it was written by a then teenager on May the 2nd, 2000. And it's a little
Oh, wow.
message to, hey, if you found this, congratulations, you're living in the house that I was in at this time. I hope the world is going well, so on and so forth. So while you know I'm atheist, but I'm a pleasantly admiring of the cultural traditions and stuff, but it made me think. I mean, I'm not sure if Nag Hammadi was also kind of a text in a waste bin or something like this. I know there were some maybe just Oxyrhynchus, but it was like, well, maybe that Josiah story is plausible, even if it wasn't factually accurate, because I just had that moment of discovering what someone had hidden away for 20 odd years on the off chance that, you know, someone would remodel the bathroom and discover it.
Yeah, exactly. No, I used to do this thing when I was a classroom teacher where I would have the students write a note to themselves. And I said, you know, I'm going to mail these 25 years from now.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and that always freaked them out. But, you know, the whole concept is 25 years from now, you're going to get this letter to yourself in the mail. I don't read them. I seal them up. They're in a safety deposit box, basically a little safe over here. And in 25 years. So I think my first group goes out in a couple of years because it was 2003, 2004.
Wow.
So in a few years from now, and a lot of those students I'm, you know, friends with on Facebook and those places, and it's fun to see them grow up and have their own kids and get involved in the community. And I know they've forgotten about it, but it's always fun to get this little envelope in the mail and you're like, oh my gosh, this is me in eighth grade or this is me in 10th grade writing to myself and, you know, kind of expressing that. But yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. You know, it's always fun. Like I said, we just moved into this house and we found a series of cookbooks from the 1950s. Ooh. This house was built in 1927. Yeah. So, and you could tell they were well used and well loved. And we're going to try some recipes just because, you know, the spirit of the house here is like, hey, you know, this stuff used to be cooked here. Maybe we should try it. Those are fun. And I agree with you. I think there's something to that story that gets preserved. I don't think that the Deuteronomy story and the whole history and the reason behind First and Second Kings and Samuel, sort of the editing of Samuel and eventually Chronicles. I don't think those were put together just to sort of set up Josiah, but I think a later group, probably the Hasmoneans, who were trying to justify this sort of new corporate entity that the Hasmonean dynasty was pushing into effect after the Maccabean Revolt. I think they were really using that. I think they're using some of those traditions of, well, we did find this scroll and it had a lot of stuff in it, because I'm sure
it happens, like, you know, you rummage through some old and I guess I'm not sure if they would have had rabbis at the time, but local leader XYZ had preserved some old correspondence or something. Hey, there's some pretty good ideas in here. I'm sure that's a universal experience.
Yeah, rabbis are, it's kind of a fun thing. We think now, for the most part, synagogues and rabbis are late first century. So after the Jewish War, before Bar Kokhba. When people call Jesus a rabbi, that's a little bit of reading back into it, because I don't know if Jesus would have known that term. He would have known teacher, I guess. But anyway, that's the whole side thing. But yeah, I think that, you know, there's that idea of finding stuff. We just moved all my books, and that's by far, I have way more books than clothes or even electronics or anything. So it's like my big roll top desk here. My books are the two things that take forever to move. And I found so many notes just kind of flipping through old books that I haven't picked up in 10, 15 years. And I had meant to go back to those books. I just had never picked them back up again. And it's like little notes to myself, like, you know, remember on Monday to pick up oranges at the grocery store. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I totally forgot that. And that's one of the fascinating things about places like, you know, Nag Hammadi or the Dead Sea Scrolls or Oxyrhynchus or the Elephantine stuff that we've been working on in Egypt. There's the intent, like, why did they bury this stuff if it's so important for a community? And yeah, there's the Jewish revolt, or yeah, you know, there's the crackdown by the, you know, Sadducees or whatever, but is that, you know, can we infer, you know, in each of the communities why that happens? And I think that's really fascinating to get back and look and you know, just to think about our own situation. But I read a great thing in the Atlantic this morning looking at the prayers that have been used over the last 2 years on Donald Trump's campaign since 2022. Yeah, and they analyzed every prayer from every rally and church service he's attended and all that kind of stuff. And by and far, the most used passage was from Second Chronicles, which is not something we typically preach on here in the US, but it's the part where Israel has broken the covenant, but if Israel will recognize that they've fallen and turn to God, then God will deliver them.
Right.
And that often gets tied to Ephesians, which says God will sort of judge those who turn away from good, and if you follow the sort of leadership of God, then God will provide salvation. So it's this kind of idea that the covenant has been broken, but it
Okay.
can be reestablished if
Yeah.
you listen to the ordained leader of God, which in this case is, Trump.
Yeah.
So in 2016, there was this really fascinating kind of meme that was built up around Trump. And Thomas and I used to talk about this on Thinking Religion all the time, where Trump was portrayed as Cyrus the Great. And we got a lot of sermons about
Messiah
how Trump,
Cyrus. Wow. It's
exactly, he's a
Iranian
broken.
Messiah Cyrus, no less, or I guess Persian
Right.
at the time.
Yeah, that's right. And he allows, the Jews in Babylon to get back home and reestablish the temple. But he was a broken vessel, but he gets called the Messiah in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. And that was sort of what we were portraying Trump as. Like, yes, he admitted to sexual violence. Yes, he did this and this and this and this. But he's a broken vessel and God's acting through him. He's sort of like Cyrus. And that makes sense in people's heads. So now we're going from that sort of recapitulation to Trump being this promised guiding figure, that's going to bring back the covenant with God because we've fallen so much and the US is in such shambles as a country and we've broken the covenant with God. So I thought that was fascinating that, sort of tied in with all of this, that Second Chronicles gets, such heavy traffic at rallies and church services that center around Trump. So yeah, I think, that's part of what we do, whether we admit it or not. We interpret and reinterpret to our own devices and our own needs, and whether that does justice to a text, it's really up to the listener and the hearer, as it always has been.
Is so I know everyone knows, as does everyone, that so Trump got shot on, I guess, a week ago, more than a week ago,
About 2 weeks ago, yeah.
I would be curious to know if, well, first off, Trump is pretty old, but assuming he campaigns or goes around for another number of years, I would wonder if the prayers said in his presence would relate to, I think it's in Mark, like the snake handling stuff, the point, it will not poison you. It was kind of a, there was a theme of God makes you invulnerable, and I would wonder if that would become the more favored version because he survived an assassination attempt, and that's just on an objective basis, that's pretty impressive. So I would be curious to know in an alternate timeline, does that wind up becoming the dominant reference point?
Yeah, I think there's still I think some of that is definitely already taken hold. I know just anecdotally talking to people like, family members of mine who are Trump supporters, that's definitely part of the talking point is, Sam, if he wasn't meant to be, our leader figure, he wouldn't have turned his head and he would have, been killed on live TV and that would have been horrible. And yeah, that would have been disastrous for our country in more ways than one, I think. But yeah, I think there's definitely sort of that messianic fervor about Trump being God's appointed one, Trump being God's chosen one to lead our country back to the covenant or back to greatness. But, let's make America great again, talk. And for those of us who follow this stuff, I'm not, I will say I lean one way, but I'm not like a huge person this way or a huge person that way. I like to figure things out. I think that the troublesome part for me is what people ascribe to being great, and in some ways that's you know, white, cis, you know, heteronormative, sort of Christian based, you know, this weekend, this weekend, Trump was speaking to a group of Christians at a faith meeting in Florida and said as much. And he said, look, you know, I love you, you beautiful Christians. And if you vote for me, you'll never have to do it again.
Right.
And, you know, that's been picked up as does he mean that because he can't run for president after this? Or does he mean like we're not going to have to vote again? Because, it's a mess. And no one really enjoys this part of our, you know, election cycle in the United States, especially because our cycles last for so long compared to places like Great Britain or even Canada. And everyone's like, oh, we only have 100 days, so how can we nominate a new candidate? And I'm like, Britain did a whole election in like 70-80 days, and they have a, you know, it looks like a pretty interesting prime minister now. And you know, if Britain can do it, we can do it. So I wish we had sort of a more compact, less money fueled, less Hollywood style election season, election cycle, because it really just cognitively and I think mentally, it just stresses everyone out to the point where we just hold our nose and pull the voting machine or push the button as we do now. And, you know, we just want it to be over with. And that sort of defeatist attitude, I think, is detrimental to a democracy or a Republican democracy. So hopefully in the near future, the young people here will come to their senses and say, there's too much money in all of this. There's too much back and forth. Social media has ruined the whole thing. So we've got to redraw this and figure out a better way to do it, because there's nothing in the Constitution about this. And this is why George Washington didn't want political parties, I think.
I read that he was chosen partly because he didn't have kids, and so there wouldn't be possible to like create a political dynasty. Although I think, John Adams' son, the second president's son, also wound up becoming a president for a while. So,
John Quincy's son. It was a fascinating thing. And there were many, many calls for Washington to keep on going as president. And he said, no, two is good. But at the same time, he was having major issues with things like his teeth. And, you know, he's famous for having these wooden teeth.
Yeah,
they weren't necessarily wooden. They were made of ivory and other human teeth from some of his enslaved folks.
Wow.
But yeah, he evidently paid them for their teeth. But I don't know. His last set of dentures was in the Smithsonian. And evidently he had one good tooth left during his second election. And he was very, very cognizant of that. Yeah. So brush your teeth, kids. You know, whether it was health or whatever, he decided not to, and that set the precedent. But yeah, there were lots of calls for him to be sort of a king, you know, monarch type figure, and he said no, you know, we're not going to go down that road again. I'm glad that, you know, he did that, and now it's in our Constitution as an amendment, you know, that you only get twice. Unless something happens, which sounds like some people might want to happen. I think it's fascinating that we keep sort of playing and replaying these roles of reinterpretation and burying texts that, you know, we think are important and coming back and finding them later and saying, well, this is interesting. Like, you know, why didn't this book make it into, you know, the canon of the New Testament? Because, wow, Enoch's really, really fun. You know, those types of things that I think we gloss over when we try to sort of simplify things like religion or textual criticism.
Yeah, so we don't have term limits in Canada. I was just pulling it up on the screen here. So our longest serving prime minister, William Lyon Mackenzie King, maybe by the standards of his day, you know, reasonably upright person, a number of beliefs and attitudes, which we find important today, not unusual. But yeah, he was prime minister for 21 years. It wasn't consecutive.
Wow.
But I'm going to guess that's mainly a product of, that political party being dominant and the other parties, like, you know, doing too much infighting. But 21 days. So he never married. And I believe he wasn't married. He definitely didn't have kids. And I believe he had meetings or seances where he would try to talk to his dead mother. So this is the era before social media. Like, you could never get away with that. That's possibly, he would have been borked in no time flat in the modern era. But he was from the early 20s to a little bit after World War II. And I can't fathom that kind of ability to keep a coalition together. I'm sure the press would have done their best to cover stories. Mind you, he did oversee, like, I would imagine that if you're the prime minister during World War II, yeah, they're probably not going to switch horses. But hard to imagine not accumulating enough baggage to be able to last more than 10 years. Like, there is kind of a rule of thumb where most in the Canadian political system, it's unusual for a political party to stay in power for more than 10 years. And so Justin Trudeau is kind of creeping up on that right now. He definitely won't get elected in polling. But his dad got beaten after about 11, 12 years in office.
The opposition had a
minority. They made a very foolish, incalculated move. And then Trudeau Sr. swept back into power on a total fluke. He'd already decided to retire, basically. But then he wound up being prime minister for another, like, 5 years. So it's hard to imagine being able to keep your coalition together and not systematically alienate little slices here and there and wind up not shrinking back into the secondary party.
And that's what's, I think, interesting, about American or U.S. politics, is that we've always prided ourselves on not being, a parliamentary system, but we find ourselves, I think, because of things like social media and just, cable news being on 24/7 and TikTok and those things, we find ourselves really sort of being in a parliamentary system. So, Biden had his little core base that, people did not want him to leave, but people on this side said, hey, you got to go, Joe. And then we had, groups over here saying, you got to go. So one of the big concerns about Biden stepping down or deciding not to run was, if Kamala's going to replace him, or if whoever's going to replace him has to appease the squad, the far left. Yeah. They have to appease the Blue Dog Democrats. You got to appease, this group, that group. And the political pundits all say, well, the Democrats rule by consensus of all these factions, whereas Republicans are a little more streamlined in their approach. And I just keep thinking about, the UK or Canada or France. And I'm like, this is parliamentary. People younger than me, like, my wife is 7 years younger, and she's just gets so infuriated. And she's like, why do we only have two choices? Why can't we have a Green Party and a Conservative Party and this party and that party? And I don't know what it will take for the US to get away from the two-party system, because there's so much money wrapped up in it. But I could definitely see that happening in a generation where, you get a serious third, fourth party candidate, because people are just so done with the two-party system. And I think it's on its last legs as a political framework that no one really likes, except for the people at the top who are getting paid well to run it.
Right. We did have, I think, when Justin Trudeau was elected about 9 years ago, one of the things he ran on was reforming the first-past-the-post system. Because we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, like, we probably have 5 political parties in government. Sort of, there's 3 national ones, there's 1 Quebec-only one, there's a Green Party as well. And what happened was that there was a nonpartisan study. They decided, I think it was a single transferable vote. So basically, you basically rank people, and if no one gets 50%, then the people from the lowest rung, their second choice gets counted and so forth. So it's not all that unlike the French sort of two-round system that they have. The challenge was that the third biggest party, the New Democratic Party, wanted proportional representation because that would help them the most. The Liberal Party wanted a single transferable vote because that would help them the most. It is more likely that more New Democrat people would support Liberals as a last-ditch effort rather than moving to the conservatives. And the conservatives won the current system because that's the only system where they could effectively obtain a majority government. And so it looks like we're going to be heading for a conservative majority when our next election gets held within 18 months or so. The odds that we're going to have a electoral reform, it's not going to be on the in development until whenever the conservatives lose power and some collection of other people say, well, let's try some other system.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because we have the same talks with things like the Electoral College right now, and that is in our Constitution. So unless 38 states get together and say, we don't really like this, we're stuck with the Electoral College. It doesn't mean there's a two-party system. I know a few states, I think in the last time we had Democratic primaries that mattered back in 2020, they were doing stacked rank elections, which I think is fascinating. I know a number of local municipalities have moved to that for things like county and city elections, which are, you know, more or less not as political. I love that idea, but that's really interesting. And we had the same kind of a thing where more conservative people here are very much in favor of the Electoral College because you get things like North and South Dakota having four senators, basically all Republican. And even though there's only about 350,000 people in those two states, they have as much representation as California, you know, our big Democratic state. Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, while Washington, D.C., that has 4 million people, you know, in its city limits, has no representation and will not have a representation as long as the conservatives are there. Or Puerto Rico becoming a state. You know, there's always calls for Puerto Rico, and I think that would be great. But, it's fascinating to see those sort of cross-border things. And that flips, you know, and that's one of the fascinating things when you talk about going back to Judea, when you talk about the political and sort of religious parties that get involved in this stuff, I think about our Whig Party, which was a major ruling party in the early part of our country's history that fell apart because of coalition. Yeah, and then we had the Civil War and the Republican Party with Abe Lincoln pops up. And the Democratic Party used to be the party of the slave owners and the slave people. You know, so
which is like the historic conservative color, and I think the Republicans are red because that historically is the reforming liberal minded, which is just so fascinating.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, it's the party of blood, you know, and was it Thomas Jefferson? No, Thomas Paine, one of the two. The tree of liberty must be, you know, watered by the blood of patriots.
Right.
You know, that kind of idea.
Well, I bet when he was writing that, he was like, oh, well, this couldn't possibly get misinterpreted or used in a terrible fashion in the future.
Right. Right. Yeah. All of our very interesting and problematic early founders here with
early zealots
politics.
I remember reading, I think it was the Iliad, where they had this catalog of ships, you know, all these guys who joined Menelaus is going to go rescue or his wife, whatever. I read an interpretation that this was basically a way of establishing some sort of coalition. Okay, so all of you, you know, we're all related together, therefore we're gonna we all share this cultural story about this great war, so everyone who's on our team, quote unquote, your village or whatever will get a mention in this thing which unifies us, this culturally unifying story. And I would imagine that with like the tribes, the 12 tribes, which just includes like a couple half tribes and the guys sort of jammed in later. Is there a theory on whether that's like sort of a political coalition? It's like, okay, us, bunch of neighbors, but not quite the same origin groups. And then, you'll all be in the club in this little paragraph in our cultural story.
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. There's definitely some political implications of that. And you've got the Northern Kingdom, you know, with centered around Samaria, eventually the Amorite dynasty, which was much more prosperous and much more cosmopolitan in many ways than what became the Southern Kingdom around Jerusalem, which was basically just two tribes. So you have Jude and Benjamin. But everyone else, the other 10 tribes were Northern Kingdom. Yeah, that's, and sometimes definitely seen as kind of a political reshaping and a much later sort of readaptation of these groups. It reminds me of Cleisthenes, who was an early ruler of Athens.
And
I think it's around 500 BCE. And he writes about the 10 tribes of Athens. And
I forgot about that. The Deans or something. There's a grouping of some sort.
Yep. So if you were an Athenian citizen, not an enslaved person, which most were, but if you were a citizen, you were a member of one of those tribes. And in the marketplace in the Agora, there were the statues of the 10 tribes. And it was kind of a reminder of, hey, we're a little different, but we're all in this together. So even in Athens, you had that kind of coalition building, I guess, if you will. And that was definitely a play, I think, in the formation of what we call the tribe.
Right.
Or just the description of them. And then we get different tribes depending on which text you're reading. So, you know, what we get in Genesis isn't necessarily the same as in Numbers. So, you know, there's some artistic liberty there as well, which is fascinating, you know, because, again, those are stories that are being written much later than when they were, you know, purported to have happened. But, you know, something like the Iliad, I think, would have been actually, you know, composed as a piece well before while we get it as Genesis. Don't say that in Sunday school, but I think you know, the conception of that is very important. And even today, you know, it's one of those things where you know, on your X or your Twitter, you know, profile, you put I'm a liberal Democrat, or I'm a Republican conservative, or I'm, you know, I'm not a Republican but I'm a conservative, or I'm this and that. And we fall into these tribes still, and those tribes are part of some sort of coalition, whether you like it or not. And that's how we derive identity. You know, and you can put a little thing on your Facebook profile, you know, a little thing on your picture, a little badge, or you can label something, or, you know, however you want to do that. But we still do that. You know, we all like Manchester United, or we like the Chicago Cubs, or, you know, whatever. And that tribal instinct, I don't think we'll ever not be a part of humanity, especially with things so fraught as religion and politics.
Right. Like I did read, there's this book I read recently, Big Gods. It was about sociological studies suggesting why, I don't know, moralizing religions, maybe moralistic religions grown at the expense of, you know, morally neutral, like the Olympian gods, morally neutral religions. And I think one of the points made in the book was that religion, and maybe now in a different way, secular law-based societies, give you the ability to collaborate with people who aren't your kin. And 99%+ of human history was in these little tribe groups. And so structures that allow you to maintain kinship level cooperation outside of your little group of 100 odd people were very helpful in community survival and your genes getting passed on and so forth. So I think I know the US Inflation Reduction Act, I work in clean energy, it's this big transformative industrial policy kind of a thing. I know it's been attacked from various sides because the technologies any particular person likes will be supported, but it also supports a whole bunch of technologies that anyone, wherever they are, don't like. And so that seems like almost one of these coalition kind of things where, like, you know, everyone, you know, you get your treat or whatever, you get the thing that you're passionate about in order to get a coalition big enough to actually move something through your guys' system, which seems to have a lot of blockages or delays or something. So
yeah, exactly. And you know, it's that same story. And that's one of the things now, is we can't get legislation passed on this because we don't have the coalition of senators, or, you know, the House isn't going to pass this because blah blah blah. And we try to look above that, or when we talk about, you know, people of faith, you know, doing the same thing, and we have groups like the United Methodist Church that is splitting right now, just really? Like the Episcopal Church. Yeah, United Methodist Church is splitting over things like the LGBTQ question and issues on that side. So you've got what's called the Global Methodist Church now and the United Methodist Church. And it's a mess because typically the UMC, the United Methodist Church, owns the property where a church is. And,
right,
you know, so there's a lot of legal stuff going on, just like we had with the Episcopal Church here in the U.S. And it's fascinating to see that. And even the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, that I came out of, there's a big push for reevaluating whether that's a structure that's still there, because the coalition, like all coalitions, break apart. And, right, you know, so that's the danger of relying on that. But we've got to wrap up here in a second, but Dunbar's number is something that I think people, you know, really need to think about. And there's pushback on it, rightfully so, but the concept is something like 150, 154 people that you can really know.
Yeah,
it's sort of the limit, and that's your tribe. And then, you know, you might elect a leader who can go interface with other tribes, but, you know, biologically, you're sort of at that number as a top thing. So that's why when you have 5,000 friends on Facebook, it sort of fries your brain, because you're not supposed to know that kind of information about 5,000 people.
Right.
And yeah, so I think there's something to be said for that. And, you know, we are in this transitory period, I think just biologically, trying to figure out, you know, the brain science behind groups and bonding and you know, go watch Chimp Empire on Netflix, and you know, it sort of helps you conceptualize some of that. You know, we as primates would do well to look back to our you know, relatives in nature, and again, I hate the word nature, our relatives in you know, outside of these human constructs that we make, you know, and really think about, you know, how and who we are as not just biological, but also, I would say spiritual, but conscious-based beings, you know, something right. that, and I think all of nature has consciousness, so I'm not ascribing yeah. that as something special as a human, but we are so materialistic, and we think we can overcome things like that, that I don't know, I think there's something there.
That seems like almost one of those Platonic-type splits where it's like, where there is perhaps a visualization of some sort of objective, rational, ideal, maybe, that people think, policy enthusiasts especially think we should all ascribe to, but life is very messy. And so so we have all these cases where we are, we live the world through a glass darkly kind of a thing, as opposed to this pristine, ideologically pure, you know, heavenly sphere kind of a thing.
Well, and we're never going to see clearly, you know, and that's a great use of all. We're never going to see clearly until we realize we're a part of all this, and we're a part of each other, and right. we're not better than the wood that we cut down to chop, you know, to make our houses. We are a part of the cosmos in the same way that a leaf of grass is. And if we, you know, would step outside of our own materialistic heads of us versus them for a moment and see the world turned upside down and kind of that interconnectedness, I think it would go a long way to sort of moving us along as the species we're meant to be as a part of all this.
Right.
Not to sound all.
Yeah. I guess we're going to sign off here, but yeah, great catching up with you, Sam, and I'll do this again soon.
Yeah, we'll do it again soon. It's good to talk to you. And if you're listening, if you have any questions, you know, feel free to chime in down in the comments, and I'll get those to Matthew as well. And we'll certainly do this again, Matthew.
Super. All right.
Thanks, buddy.